And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, just found out there is a company that has shipped a vaccine for coronavirus for testing. It's called Moderna Therapeutics, and it's the vaccine shows a lot of promise with Corona starting to really make inroads in a number of countries. Might well be something worth keeping an eye on. Well, one of the things that always fascinated me has been conspiracies. And it turns out, even though history has downplayed them, that a major player during the Civil War was the Knights of the Golden Circle. And interrelated to them were the Knights Templar, who apparently had quite a bit of involvement in various locales within this country. There were a number of forgotten letters found in the Grand Chancellor of the Knight Templars of Canada's records that addressed Albert Pike, General Albert Pike. Now, Pike had an interesting history. Some people saw him as a demigod. Others saw him as the devil incarnate. And behind the scenes, he dominated a large portion of U.S. history for a good number of years. Now, he was a man with many secrets, most of which he took to the grave with him. And over his lifetime, he was seen as a problem to a large number of Americans. Now, he became a well-known in the esoteric community. Came from New England originally. In 1825, he wrote the entrance exams to Harvard, passed, and was accepted. But unfortunately, he didn't have the money to go with his intellect. So he wasn't able to complete his formal education. He was actually self-educated. And at first, he started out as a school teacher. Moved from one New England town to another, and then he wound up in Nashville, Tennessee, and eventually in St. Louis. But his personal history shows there was another side to this man that very few people knew about. Now, he was described as an imposing figure. He stood 6 feet two and weighed 300 pounds, had a long beard and hair that hung down below his shoulders. Now, at a time when most men weren't that tall, he was really imposing. My great-great-grandfather, who was an officer in the Civil War, was described by the family as a big man. And I inherited his Civil War uniform. Now, I'm 6'1", and at the time, I probably weighed, I don't know, 220, 230. I couldn't get one arm in that uniform, so what they described as big wasn't so big. Now, like most self-made men, he was somewhat restless. He wanted to explore the West, which the U.S. had taken over as a result of the Louisiana Purchase. 1831, he embarked on a hunting and trapping expedition and took him to Taos, New Mexico. Wanted to have his horse get away from him. So he was forced to walk the 1,300 miles to Fort Smith, Arkansas. And what that did is it showed everybody this was a man of strength and determination. And in Arkansas, he decided to settle and teach school and write a series of articles for the Little Rock Advocate. Now, he made a good bit of money doing this, and his articles were a critical success almost from the start. In fact, he made enough money to actually purchase the Advocate in 1834. Of course, when you're a self-made man, sometimes your known history isn't exactly the truth. Just prior to his purchase of the business, he married Marianne Hamilton, a descendant of Alexander Hamilton. She came from a very wealthy family. It suggested a large dowry had been given to Pike, which was the custom. And from the outset, the newspaper promoted the viewpoint of the Whig Party, stoking the political volatility that existed throughout Arkansas and other southern states at this point in time. Now remember, this is the 1830s up to the 1840s. During that time period, Pike studied law and was admitted to the bar in 1837, mostly because he had written a book called the Arkansas Form Book that served as a guidebook for lawyers for generations after that. At this point, he sold the Advocate and concentrated on representing the claims of many Native Americans tribes against the federal government. Now, this was somewhat unusual, you might understand, because most American pioneer families believed the Native Americans had no rights to their homeland. 1852, he represented the Creek Nation, and in 54, he represented both the Choctaw and the Chickasaw. Took their claims all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And although he was successful in defending their claims regarding their ceding of tribal lands, the American government never properly compensated the tribes in accordance with what the Supreme Court told the government to do. Well, this is the first interesting facet of Pike's character. Although he retained his affiliation with the Whig Party during the 30s and 40s, which adamantly opposed the Democratic belief in manifest destiny, he remained a strong advocate for slavery. So you have to ask yourself, how can a man fight so hard for Native American rights at the same time maintain such a strong belief in the right of men to enslave other men? It just didn't really add up. So you had to ask yourself, what qualities did Pike see in Native Americans that he didn't see in the African American race, especially given his involvement with Freemasonry, which, as a basic tenet, considered all men equal and free? So you have to ask yourself, had he learned of something more that spoke of prior contact and the strategic intermarriage between the medieval European Knights Templar and the native North Americans? There have long been legends of such involvement. In fact, there were stories of Native American Freemasons going all the way back before the Revolution. Now, one thing is obvious. Pike strongly believed in and fought for his convictions. Joined the regiment of Arkansas Mounted Volunteers, commissioned as a troop commander with the rank of captain in June of 46. Fought with distinction at the Battle of Buena Vista during the Mexican War. Got an honorable discharge in June of 1847. Now, after his discharge, he became disillusioned with the Whig Party that refused to take a stand on slavery. And over the next 10 years, his increasing disillusionment with federalism would lead to a stand in support of the freedom of individual states. And by 1861, he was arguing in his writings that the individual states' rights superseded national law. He strongly supported the idea of Southern secession, continuing a strong pro-slavery position. Now, it's said he was one of the main Masonic entities behind the instigation of secession following Abraham Lincoln's election as president. December 20th, 1860, the state of South Carolina, headquarters of the southern jurisdiction of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which Pike basically controlled, was the first state to secede, with Mississippi leaving the Union the very next day. Now, there's a lot of support for the idea that he actually had sympathy for both sides of the what many refer to as a family squabble. He decided to take sides with the Confederates. At that time, he continued to hold out hope for a negotiated settlement that would strengthen the state's rights of self-determination while restraining federal dominance. You know, and in support of what Pike had to say, the theory behind the Constitution is states joined the Union for certain benefits, but the Constitution acted as a curb, if you will, on the power of the federal government. And if they joined freely, they should be able to leave freely. At least that's what the seceding states had to say, and of course, didn't happen. But the inevitable arrived when the prospect of abolition led the nation into civil war. 1861, at the beginning of the Civil War, Pike asked the newly formed Confederate government to appoint him Confederate envoy to the Native Americans. And Jefferson Davis was more than pleased to grant this request. And Pike's first official act as envoy was to negotiate a treaty between the Confederate government and the Cherokees, which was led by the famous Cherokee chief John Ross. And the Indian Confederate treaty read to Pike's being commissioned as a brigadier general on November 20, 1861, and he was given a command in the Indian Territory. And over the next 6 months, he was responsible for training 3 Confederate regiments of Indian cavalry. Now, Pike led his Native American troops during the Battle of Pea Ridge, otherwise known as Elkhorn Tavern, in March of 1862. Well, at first, they swept the field of the Union forces, but fell back during a Union counterattack. Chief Ross, who would forever be known for his savagery during this battle, in which his men scalped Union soldiers, and some of them were still alive when they were scalped. Well, when Pike was ordered to send his troops to Arkansas in May of 1862, he resigned his commission in protest. He had given his personal assurance to Ross and the other chiefs the natives would only fight within the Indian Territory in defense of their negotiated land claims. And as a result of this protest, along with the brutal conduct of his native troops in the field, he was charged with insubordination and treason against the Confederacy. Well, in 1863, Pike, who was facing arrest on the orders of Jefferson Davis, escaped into the hills of Arkansas and lived as a fugitive till the Confederate Army accepted his resignation November 11, 1863. After this, he was allowed to return to his family in Little Rock, where he resumed his law practice. Between 64 and 1866, although decommissioned, he continued to be heavily involved in Civil War affairs, both officially and secretly. Now, it's been purported, although it's never been totally confirmed, that Pike was a founding member of the parallel military espionage organization known as the Knights of the Golden Circle. Now, this group was first formed in 1854 and was immediately and intimately involved in a conspiracy to assassinate President Lincoln. Now, it's been said that Pike was the only conspirator in Lincoln's assassination to escape hanging, and he was behind the founding of the KKK at the end of the Civil War. It is known that he was the Grand Dragon of the Tennessee chapter of the KKK, as well as the Grand Council's Judiciary Council. Also instrumental in writing the Klan's rituals, which were based loosely on those of the Scottish Rite Freemasonry. Now, Nathan Bedford Forrest, another Confederate general, was actually the man known to have formed the Ku Klux Klan, though he eventually broke with them because he didn't like the way things were going. With the formal end of the Civil War on May 9, 1865, Pike fled Arkansas with his wife and family and headed to Mexico. Well, after a change of heart, he shifted from one state to another, narrowly avoiding arrest by Union troops. He was considered quite the catch by the Bluecoats. By June of 1865, he had taken refuge in Canada, where he stayed for about 2 months till Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, granted him a parole August 30th, 1865. Now, Pike would never accept a full pardon because accepting a pardon implies he was guilty of treason. But he did accept a parole. Well, that led to another major mystery about Pike. Why was it so important to him to maintain his commission as a Brigadier General of the Confederate Army and his actions in instigating the secession of the 11 Southern states from the Union did not constitute treason? Now, he'd been charged with treason by the Confederate government and didn't dispute that charge. Some said it was a matter of principle, or others said it was something more complex relating to his insistence his actions were true to the Constitution of the United States. How could you be an official in a breakaway government and still be true to the principles of the Constitution of the United States? He never explained the conundrum. Probably the most enduring aspect of his career relates to his rise within the American Freemasonry. In the early 40s onward, he developed a phenomenal, distinguished Masonic career that would lead to a remarkable series of synchronistic events in the history of North America, most of which the general public doesn't know anything about to this day. Now, his encounter with fraternal lodges began with the membership within the Old Fellows Lodge in the early 1840s. From there, he quickly transitioned into the Masonic Lodge and rapidly rose through its state and national ranks, including full Knights Templar honors in 1853 at Hugh DePayne's Commandery in Little Rock. Elected Sovereign Grand Commander of the Scottish Rite Southern Jurisdiction, January 3, 1859, a position that gave him absolute control over the Southern jurisdiction for the rest of his life. Now, among many things, he's probably best known for having consolidated and developed the Southern jurisdiction's 32-degree rituals, which are still in use within that jurisdiction, and for having written the ultimate book on Freemasonry, titled Morals and Dogma, the Ancient Accepted Scottish Rites of Freemasonry, which was published in 1871. Now, on April 2, 1891, he died inside the old house, which at that time was the temple headquarters of the Southern jurisdiction in Washington, D.C. Surprisingly, given his role in the Civil War, by a special act of Congress, his remains were removed from their original burial plot and reburied in a stone crypt located within the walls of the new house, which is the current temple building in Washington, D.C. Larger-than-life statue of Pike dominates the Judiciary Square neighborhood of Washington, D.C. Given the current turmoil surrounding the removal of statues of Confederate generals from prominent locations across the U.S., it's significant nobody's ever raised the issue of removing Pike's statue. Now, Pike corresponded with many other high-ranking Masons around the world, including a lasting correspondence with Colonel William James Barry, MacLeod Moore, then Supreme Grand Master of the Knights Templar of Canada. Moore is credited with introducing Scottish Rite Masonry, Templarism, the Conclave, and Rosicrucianism to Canada and North America, becoming both the first Supreme Grand Master of the Sovereign Great Priory of Canada and Supreme Magus of the Sotias Rosicruciana and the Catalavis Federalis. Moore provided Pike with the ancient rituals of these orders, which he'd gotten during his overseas travel, which allowed Pike to extend his influence over Southern jurisdiction Scottish Rite Masonry throughout the United States. Well, to some come full circle, so to speak, about 4 years ago, the Grand Historian for the Sovereign Great Priory, Knights Templar of Canada, came into the care of a set of private letters between Pike and MacLeod Moore. The correspondence lasted Pike's lifetime, culminating in his receiving the honorary appointment of Provincial Grand Prior of the Sovereign Great Priory, Knights Templar of Canada, in 1878. And what's in those letters has never been presented publicly. Now, the Supreme Grand Master, Sovereign Great Priory, Knights Templar of Canada, wrote a book called The Last Refuge of the Knights Templar, The Ultimate Secret of the Pike Letters. He actually did it in a novel form, though it's based on a lot of true information. The man's name is William Mann, and Simon & Schuster quite often sends me books to review. And this one is fascinating, if even 50% of it is actually factual. It gives an entirely new area of research into some of the activities that took place with the various secret societies in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s. Now, the Knights of the Golden Circle, which I mentioned, history has tried to dismiss as wannabes, but in actuality, behind the scenes, they were involved in quite a number of very unusual activities. The plan that they put forth was the invasion and annexation of Mexico as a state that supported slavery. And they raised a tremendous amount of money, an unbelievable amount of money. And at the end of the Civil War, they hid that money. And certain families were appointed as guardians. One of those guardians was a man named Jesse James. And he hid, in fact, that was supposedly the impetus for his career of robbing anything that moved. He kept some of the money, and a lot of that money was hidden. Now, the one book that I've worked on from time to time is a history of the Knights Templar and a history of the Knights of the Golden Circle. Quite often, their paths crossed. And whenever they did, it gave a very interesting view of the world that we don't often take into account. Also, keep in mind, John Wilkes Booth was said by many to be part of a small group. Initially, they said he acted alone. Then it became a small group of conspirators. In actuality, there's a lot of evidence he was actually in the employ of the Confederate Secret Service, which was quite active up until late 1865 and early 1866. Just as the Odessa smuggled a lot of Nazi war criminals out of Europe at the end of World War II, so too did the Confederate Secret Service help smuggle a lot of people out of the southern U.S. In fact, had it not been for some bad luck, Jefferson Davis would have been wound up in Cuba and continued the war in the hopes of forcing a negotiated peace. Now, what very few people understand is at the end of the war, the Confederacy had a lot of money at its disposal. What it didn't have was everything it needed to continue to wage war. In fact, the reason Lee surrendered was because the train that he expected to have food on it had guns and ammunition. His troops were starving. They didn't have shoes. They didn't have clothes. They had guns and ammunition, but that only goes so far. The Confederate Treasury left Richmond. And along the way, its custodians parceled out a good bit of gold and Union greenbacks. Finally, in the belief that a third front was going to be opened up in Texas and Mexico, because several Confederate generals took their troops into Mexico. In fact, I forget which unit it was, but they never surrendered. They buried their regimental colors in the Rio Grande and went into Mexico. See, the Emperor of Brazil, that had an emperor at that point in time, very much supported the South. In fact, there was a town in Brazil that was settled and controlled by the Confederate States of America. And until the 1960s, every morning they raised the Confederate flag. But over time, disease and the fact that there was no way in the world they were ever going to succeed had its effect, and the population dwindled. I understand the town is still there. It's got very few people left in it. But the Confederate treasury was put on a train heading this direction. It was supposed to come to El Paso, be picked up by a guard from this Confederate regiment, and take it into Mexico. But the Union troops threatened it, and the treasure vanished somewhere around El Paso. Nobody really knows for sure. All anybody knows is when the train cars were found, they were empty. Excuse me. Now, there are several locations where it is clear that treasure was buried, both in the South, a couple of places in Virginia, a couple in Georgia. Some of it even got as far south as Florida and vanished into the Everglades. But the bulk of it was supposed to come here. Now, it makes you wonder. See, there was a very strong Southern support here in El Paso. And the Fort Bliss actually was a Confederate installation for a time. And a lot of very prominent people in this town were strong Southern supporters. Had the North been less aggressive in its policies, Texas would probably have stayed in the Union. But they felt they didn't really have any choice. Now, that Confederate treasury, if it could be found today, it's just, you know, the gold, $20 gold pieces from the 1860s, if you had one of them, you're probably looking at $100,000 plus. So if you found, let's just say, 50,000 of them, you could retire. Well, that's what makes treasure hunting such a fascinating hobby. And there are quite a number of places where descendants of folks who were members of the Knights of Golden Circle actually still guard the treasure that was buried by their ancestors. They've never thought about taking it for themselves. They always believe they're serving a higher cause by carrying out the instructions left by their ancestor. Several locations in southern Arkansas, my father's family came out of Arkansas, and the stories I heard about lost and hidden treasure, if just half of them were half true, it'd be a wonderland for somebody with a metal detector. My great-grandmother was still alive until I was up in my teens, and she had letters and books and what have you from some of her ancestors. And there was, for giving an example, there was an aunt of hers. My great-grandmother died in her, I guess she was in her 90s. So her aunt would have probably been, if she had been still alive and my grandmother died, she'd been 120. So we're talking about the 1870s, 1880s, and no earlier than that, because my great grandmother was the daughter-in-law of my Civil War ancestor, who died in 1885, and she was already married to his son. So we're probably talking about her aunt would have probably lived in the 1840s, 1850s. And in those days, you didn't come in the house from working in the fields without washing your hands on the back porch. And then you were supposed to throw the water into the flowers that grew along the edge of the porch. And one of the letters talks about the fact that she had some company come, and she told them not to throw her throw the water on this one particular rose bush because that's where she buried her money. And I asked my grandmother, my great-grandmother, was that serious? And she said, oh, yeah. She was a wealthy woman and known for, she didn't trust banks. She had her money buried. And I asked her where the house had been, and nobody seemed to remember specifically. But my other great-grandmother, even in the edge of the community, still raised animals, chickens and what have you. And she'd send me out to feed the chickens. And one day I was feeding the chickens and collecting the eggs. And in this one particular nest, I felt something that wasn't an egg. And it turned out to be about $150 in silver dollars. I thought I'd become a wealthy man. And I went in the house and showed it. And that was my great-grandmother's bank. That's where she put her money that she got. So a lot of family stories make fascinating reading, especially when you are able to confirm that they're true. I started doing the family history when I was 15. I've got about 32,000 names in it right now, going back to 800 B.C. And some of the folks I'm descended from are absolutely mind-blowing. I'll publish that book. Nobody's ever successfully published a family history of my family. They've collected the information, but they've always died for whatever reason before the book came out. I plan on breaking that record and getting the book out. My 85th book came out last week. I'll be unveiling it at the Tucson Book Festival. And if a few things come to pass, we're going to turn El Paso into the movie capital of the West. Some of the stories here, I mean, we have a lot of movies filmed in this area, but there's nobody to support them. So we're going to see what we can do. Now, turning the page, we have talked at some length about the secret Nazi space program. There's a lot of information that holds that the Nazis actually have been able to put a man into orbit. In fact, I read an article written by one of those test pilots, and he swore that he actually had a couple of orbits of the Earth. The craft that was built was the precursor to the V-2. And in fact, it was a V-2 that was used for the initial space efforts by NASA. So certainly it had the capability of getting into orbit. The question is, did they? And if in fact they were able to put somebody into orbit, are the legends about the Nazi space program anywhere near true? Now, if you look at some of the writings that came out of folks who purport to be involved in all this, It's been well established we dwell in a multidimensional universe. And Earth is in the third dimension, which is entirely physical. But the creatures known as the reptilians, and I've had a number of people talk to me about reptilians and their contact with them. There was a young man named Jason Bishop I met during my California days. His wife was actually kidnapped by a reptilian. I don't think he ever found her. And according to the information, reptilians are actually a fourth dimension race. In Hindu physics and in theosophy, this dimension is also known as the astral plane, which all inhabitants, both reptilians and others, are composed of a finer type of matter in which the atoms vibrate at a much higher rate. And since our eyes are limited in how fast, what fast motion we can see, if it moves too fast for us to see it, as far as we know, they're invisible. Hindu holy men and scientists have explored this phenomena for centuries and recorded their observations in the books such as the Vendetta, which has attracted the interest of Western scholars lately. Vedanta, V-E-D-A-N-T-A, who now understand how this concept relates to quantum physics. If you go to Wikipedia, there's an article that begins, "Did you know the founders of quantum physics were all Vedantists and credited the Vedas for their theories?" Erwin Schrödinger, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, had a lifelong interest in Hinduism. If you remember, he's the one that came up with the theorem about Schrödinger's cat. And the Vedic philosophy influenced Nikola Tesla's understanding of free energy and the relationship between science and spirituality. And one of the things that they've put forth, which they say is a surprise to most of us because we're conditioned to believe that memories are stored in the brain, but there's actually no way to prove that. There's a well-known fact to mediums who communicate with the dead, all of whom have perfect memories of their experiences in the physical body on Earth while they were alive. Mediums are said to have learned this because that dimension is also the dwelling place of humans who've died and have lost their physical bodies, which includes the brain. Well, if they don't have the brain, how can they retain the memories that are supposedly stored in the brain? So that's why they believe that memories exist only in the astral plane and all human experiences are kept in detail in the Akashic records. I had a number of people swear to me that they had access to the Akashic records, but, you know, how do you prove something like that? Now, those records are said to be assessed by total immersion in the events of the past, and those events can actually be relived. And that's how, supposedly, psychic Edgar Casey went into a trance state. And from while in that state, he could tell his clients who they were in previous incarnations and precisely how they created the karma they were now experiencing. What I found interesting, in every case except one, every person I saw talk to every medium was some highfalutin, important individual in the past. I mean, they couldn't all be Cleopatra's lover. Now, the reptilians are said to have the power to lower their vibratory rate and to move in and out of the physical realm so as to become visible to those of us living in the third dimension. And they use that facility to a great advantage. They prefer to remain in the lower astral because they can best manipulate the human race from that dimension, frequently in the dreamscape, but also through abduction, hypnosis, and subconscious programming. And like Casey, they have access to the Akashic records so they can trace family lineages with their quantum computers and use them in their genetic abduction strategies. And since they're said to have the ability to influence unsuspecting human souls between incarnations, they can fine-tune their strategies for control of the surface population. So they don't really have a need for a continent of their own in the third dimension when they actually exist in the fourth dimension. Now, assuming any of that is accurate, it does raise quite a number of issues. You know, the most important attribute of the reptilian species is our artificial intelligence, or as we've come to call it today, AI. Reptilian technology is far more advanced than anything we can even imagine, according to those who've had, say they've had contact. Long ago, the reptilians developed quantum science, which is built into their computer technology and makes it appear to be almost magical. Now, we're not prepared to deal with that, and so, that being the case, we couldn't erect any barriers or defenses against it. And supposedly the Elohim, you might know them as the Anunnaki, realized it, and so they created they gave the newly created human a soul that's far more advanced in fourth-dimensional reptilian consciousness. There are those that say the human soul is actually sixth-dimensional. It consists of potential soul power that riddles any fourth-dimensional technology obsolete and powerless. Reptilians know that, so they spend a lot of energy trying to keep us dumbed down, so to speak. They know that once we realize our true potential power, they're out of luck. So in their laboratories, they developed a highly advanced form of AI to deal with fifth and sixth dimensional adversaries. In their travels throughout the galaxy, their scientists learned about a form of AI that has the capability to actually administer and control an entire solar system automatically, like a self-driving vehicle, and they've used it very effectively in some of the distant worlds in their empire. Now, devotees of science fiction films recognize this technology in the Cylons in Battlestar Galactica and the Stormtroopers in Star Wars. In both cases, the society functions like a clock without intervention, requiring very little oversight. It's administered by a robotic race of cyborgs, all controlled by a central quantum computer. In the original version of Battlestar Galactica, released in 1978 with Lauren Green, by far that was, in my view, the best. Cylons have absorbed 12 human colonies that way, and their surviving free humans have embarked on a desperate cross-galaxy odyssey to find a new home called Earth. This became a new TV series in 2004, and unfortunately, a lot of things were changed, not for the better. And we've all become familiar with the white-armored stormtroopers who administer the Empire in the Star Wars film. Both cases, the underlying power is really an inorganic race known as the Archons. And reptilians have learned how to utilize the Archonic energies and capabilities to administer their own controlled human civilizations. Well, you know, the Nag Hammadi Library, it's a collection of 13 ancient manuscripts discovered in a cave in southern Egypt in 1945. It was an astounding find that revealed the thinking of the earliest disciples of Jesus, who were known as the Gnostics. And many of the Gnostics' beliefs are in stark contrast to the writings of the early disciples connected to the Pauline Roman Christians as recorded in the New Testament. Now, there were English translations of the codices that were completed in the 1970s and offer what appear to be actual dialogues of the disciples. And this discovery caused a major reevaluation of the early Christian history and presented a comprehensive explanation of the Gnostic and Gnosticism. And the Gnostic codices are the earliest sources of information about the Archons. Now, John Lash is a comparative mythologist, author, and teacher. He's probably one of the most knowledgeable authorities on Gnosticism and the Archons. On his website, Metahistory, he says Archons are a species of inorganic beings that emerged in the solar system prior to the formation of the Earth. They're cyborgs inhabiting the planetary system, an alien force that intrudes subliminally on the human mind and deviates our intelligence away from its proper and sane applications. Gnostics saw the signature of the alien species that piggybacks on the worst human failings. So there are those that say the Archons are psycho-spiritual parasites. And in his internet article, the Gnostic Theory of Alien Intrusion, he says the Nag Hammadi material contains reports of visionary experiences of the initiates, including first-hand encounters with an inorganic being called Archons. Gnostic teaching explains that these entities arose in the early stage of formation of the solar system before the Earth was formed. Archons inhabit the solar system, the extraterrestrial realm as such, but they can intrude on the Earth. And because of that, it's easy to see why the reptilians would have chosen these beings to do their dirty work for them. They've implored the Archons to keep us tied down to our lowest mental physical level while they sit back and watch the show. The reptilians are without doubt mentally powerful and consequently find a way to control the Archons, having long off-world experience with them. Now, in order for the reptilians to control the human race, it was first necessary to seal us off from our friends elsewhere in the galaxy, because they knew these friends could offer assistance. It was likely to be at least as technologically advanced as the science of the reptilians. Now, this may sound like the greatest of science fiction to you, but I've talked to too many people who've reported and didn't know each other and reported experiences with creatures they called reptilians, and the descriptions are pretty much the same. So you have to ask yourself, is there in fact a race called the reptilians? And the answer seems to be there is. The problem is how to present proof in such a fashion that it's all not throwing the baby out of the bathwater, so to speak. In the early 20th century, according to those who profess to know, when the reptilians are ready for the final stage of their program to control the human race on this planet, their first priority was to select a country or racial group to work through. A group that could be relied on to carry out their complex agenda of hybridization, artificial intelligence, poisoning of the air, food and water, mind control, wars and disasters. They had to wait till the developments in science, technology, and industrialization had reached a point where their proto-human puppets, the Illuminati, were able to handle the complexities of their job. And the reptilians had thousands of years to hone their skills, during which time they had controlled millions, maybe billions of the inhabitants of planets and 21 star systems in this galaxy. They chose the Germans, which from their point of view is logical and tactical. More than any other racial group, the Germans were amazingly disciplined and able to achieve remarkable accomplishments by rapidly organizing huge industrial structures along hierarchical lines and ensuring the reporting discipline from one level to another was efficient and highly regimented. And this was the key to achieving results in large corporate, military, and governmental organizations. This type of system, each department level has little or no knowledge of the activity at other levels, and through this method, large numbers of employees can be made to produce products or carry out activities that are basically antisocial, inhuman, or even evil. And if you question them, they all come up with the Nuremberg defense: I was just following orders. It's this separation, the keeping of all groups on a strictly need-to-know basis by the management, that allows all this to happen. Now, the reptilians are said to have known this was to be necessary because they didn't want to risk a rebellion in the ranks triggered by idealistic employees if their real objectives were uncovered. They intended to implement their takeover plans through large corporate entities, and secrecy was imperative. A capitalistic corporate industrial structure was vital to their plans. They knew that democratic and socialistic political systems were antithetical to their program, and that's why they made sure to operate through anti-democratic and anti-socialist authoritarian regimes. But the major problem with this structure is the lack of creativity. When workers are forced to just follow orders, good ideas are repressed, and the consequences are a product of or a system that may be finished on time but lacks all the enhancements they would have been able to put in by incorporating the ideas and suggestions of subordinates all along the way. In other words, it has no bells and whistles. It's just the basics. And this tends to dilute the entire effort. But that's the price the elite are willing to pay to obtain the basic results. And that's why it was possible for a Kaiser and a Fuhrer to realize the accomplishments of their whims quickly, and so the reptilian planners could depend on them to achieve their social, industrial, and military goals. Also, the German workers or else soldiers didn't allow humane or ethical values to interfere with the process. To them, efficiency was everything, and human lives were just numbers. They got the job done without regard for the human toll, with no regrets whatsoever. Such an environment, the leaders at the top, in other words, those who make the policy, are all important, while the middle and low level workers are just take care of the simple, basically mindless and repetitive task. These individuals are generally disposable and easily replaceable if they show any hesitation or signs of remorse. And if you remember, Erwin Rommel, just on the rumor that he was working to overthrow Hitler, was forced to commit suicide. The most brilliant general the Germans had at their disposal, and they were willing to throw him aside because he allegedly wasn't following party line. But eventually, the managers at the top don't want to bother with all the effort and the attention it takes to fool the workers into thinking they're doing something valuable. So ultimately, they just resort to a form of slavery in which keeping track of salaries and recreation for their workers is no longer necessary. And then they do away with all the pretense. They implement Gestapo-like tactics to control the organization and get the work done with outright slavery. Now, the Herculean job necessary to effect the emergence of a unified Germany as an armed, scientific, and industrial European power at the commencement of the 20th century is basically due to the efforts and policies of one man, Prussian Prime Minister and later German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck. During the short period of his reign between 1862 and 1914, Germany was transformed from a collection of arguing independent states to a comprehensive, politically unified, highly industrialized country under the dominance of Prussia. And it began with the elevation of William I as King of Prussia in 1861 after the death of his brother, King Frederick William IV. William was dedicated to the unification of the German states. Believing that was the best way to unify Germany was through war, he depended primarily on his war minister, Count von Roon. But they weren't able to build an effective military because of the liberal opposition in Parliament. But in September of 1862, William appointed Bismarck to the office of Prime Minister. And he was a force to be reckoned with. He essentially disregarded Parliament and imposed new taxes dictatorially to pay for a new military. It was illegal, but as is often the case, strong, bold moves by one determined leader catch the vacillating opposition by surprise, and they can't muster enough unified force to defeat his or her policies. In a speech to Parliament in 1862 to justify his actions, Bismarck uttered the famous phrase that's now echoed down through the years and will come to characterize all such actions by future German dictators. He said, "The great question of our time will be decided not by speeches and resolutions of majorities, but by blood and iron." This derogatory reference to resolutions of majorities is essentially rejection of democracy and an endorsement of autocracy. And blood and iron could only mean one thing: warfare, which uses tons of iron and oceans of blood. This was a prophetic utterance by Bismarck because it was from that moment on that the new nation of Germany became a succession of dictatorships and began a worldwide reign of blood and iron for a period that lasted 83 years. There's overwhelming evidence Bismarck was really an Illuminati. a reptilian-human hybrid who was sent to implement the reptilian agenda for the 20th century. Now, whether you believe that particular view or not, there is a lot of information about men in the shadows with whom he had discussions about how to accomplish what he set out to do. Well, as with all things reptilian, it was all based on a lie because it really didn't answer the great question of our time at all, but provided a new and horrifying direction for humanity that's still in the process of being played out. You know, Bismarck was the first of a new generation of dictators, and he became the prototype of the autocratic German leader that was emulated by those who followed him. He had multifaceted talents that allowed him to handle complicated political agendas with ease. He played other European political leaders against each other as though they were pawns on a chessboard and could achieve results that seemed impossible to others. Won 3 wars in quick succession, even though he himself wasn't really a military leader. Each time he enlarged Prussian territory and influence until Prussia became the new Germany. And this allowed his autocratic successors, Kaiser Wilhelm II and Adolf Hitler, to inherit an enlarged and powerful nation. And most importantly, Bismarck's high intelligence permitted him to be at ease with the amazing industrial and technological advances that evolved during his reign. It was a time of changes that became known worldwide as the Second Industrial Revolution. Now, Bismarck himself was an autocratic conservative leader. And he instilled in the corporations he fostered a necessity to follow his lead, especially Krupp AG and IG Farben. So the leaders of these corporations inherited the same greed, ambition, and indifference to human suffering that he displayed. He even set the stage for governmental anti-Semitism that intensified later, even though the Jewish population in Prussia and Germany at that time was only 1%. An outline announcement of a talk about his book, Bismarck, A Life, by Jonathan Steinberg, held on May 26, 2011 by the Peirce Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism, based at Birkbeck University of London, says Jonathan Steinberg argued that Bismarck staged the first act of the tragedy of German Jewry. Steinberg argued not only did anti-Semitism have deep roots in the autocratic class from which Bismarck came, but also that Bismarck used it when it suited his policies. The first modern depression hit Germany in 1873, and the Jews, as prominent bankers, of course, took the blame. Bismarck abandoned his liberal allies and after 1878 set out to destroy him by crushing the Jews and their leadership. He allowed a wave of anti-Semitism to spread and watched as the Prussian Parliament had its infamous Jew debate in 1880 and the first time the unified Germany declared the Jews weren't real Germans. You know, when you point out someone as an enemy and tell those who've had problems that all their problems stem from this enemy that's been identified, you can control the mob, and that is an unfortunate fact of life. And if you can control and direct that mob so its hatred and its energy is centered on one person or group of people, you can act with impunity and put into effect any policy you want to put in. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow night. And we'll be talking more about the secret Nazi space program. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.